Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me. Welcome to a mini bonus episode. I was reading about this case and I figured if I'm interested enough to read about it, then I should probably write it down and tell it to you as well. There's a lot of lore regarding today's case, and that can make things a little bit difficult when researching from publicly available documents. So I've gone back to the original newspaper articles from 1977 and 1978 for most of the information because I figure reports from around the actual time of the events is going to be more accurate than information filtered through years of curated content. Now, how this case plays out is factual information. It's just that, well, I guess you'll see. This is the murder of Teresita Bassa.
And I know the answer to the question that everyone keeps asking. I know why you did this. You did this simply because you were not in a cave.
But was she dead on the day I arrived?
She was dead when you killed her.
I agree with the family. I hope you die in prison as well.
It disgusts me that you are allowed to exist.
Teresita Bassa was born in 1929 in the Philippines, growing up in Manila, the only child to her parents. And her father was a successful lawyer. She graduated from Assumption College in Manila. She then immigrated to Chicago, Illinois in around the early 60s, originally to study music and was working towards a master's in music at Loyola University. When her father passed away of respiratory illness, Teresita changed to studying to be a nurse, specializing as a respiratory therapist, and then she went on to work at the Edgewater Hospital just outside of Chicago city limits. Teresita was a talented pianist and taught piano for free to some kids in the neighborhood. She was remembered as being kind-hearted and exceptional at her job and also as a musician, and she lived a somewhat solitary and quiet, unassuming life. Teresita was living in a high-rise building on Pine Grove Avenue on the 15th floor. And around 7:30 on the night of February 21st, 1977, she talked on the phone to a friend of hers who was a co-worker from the hospital named Ruth Loeb for about 20 to 30 minutes. Now, according to the Chicago Tribune and an article written in March of 1978, on this call, Teresita mentioned that she had a male visitor, but she didn't give a name. Now, another thing that appears to be fact, because it's been mentioned in the early reports, was that even though Teresita was in her mid-40s, she was a virgin. She was deeply religious and never married. Why that information is important to have out there in the reporting, I do not know. There's a lot of conflicting information on this case. But about an hour after getting off the phone with Ruth, two neighbors in the building, Mario and Catherine Naz, smelled smoke and told the building's janitor, Petro Lelusa, who rang the fire alarm, evacuated the building and then notified the fire department. And as soon as the fire crew were let into Teresita's apartment by Pedro, they knew that this had been a deliberately set fire. The door had been locked from the inside. There was no signs of forced entry. However, the fire had been isolated to the bedroom. There was a box of matches left on the floor and some crumpled up bits of paper lying around that they believed would have been used as kindling. There was nothing flammable around the area of the mattress where the fire was kind of contained to. There was little other damage to the apartment aside from smoke damage. The mattress on the bed was in kind of an odd position. It appeared to have been lifted and then something placed under it. It took two firemen to lift the mattress because it was kind of like melted to the bed frame. And under it was the charred remains of 45-year-old Teresita. She was naked and in a position that suggested sexual assault. However, it was later ruled out at autopsy. Even more horrifying than her burned body was the large kitchen knife that was sticking out of her chest. Her clothing had been folded neatly next to her body, and several items of jewelry and cash were missing from her bedroom, and the apartment appeared to have been ransacked. Teresita's body was flown back to the Philippines to be interned after the autopsy had been completed, and with very few clues to go on, the case looked like it would be another of many cold cases that were in Chicago in the 1970s, a city that knew their share of brutal and senseless murders. The only clue left behind was a note that Teresita had left for herself by her phone with the words "Get tickets for AS" scribbled on it. Two detectives, Lee Eplin and Joseph Stachula, were assigned to investigate and solve Teresita's murder. So they did what most detectives would do. They set to interviewing friends, relatives, anyone that knew Teresita, and they were particularly interested in trying to identify who this AS person could be. So according to only one report that I could find, again, it was the Chicago Tribune, they put out word to the public that they were looking for information on who this person could be and likely connected in some way to the Edgewater Hospital, since Teresita's life evolved largely around her work. But I did only find one report about that, and that was in 1978, and it was the Chicago Tribune. So I would hope that it was truthful information. And it does make sense that they would do that. It's also a little bit of a hint that a lot of the lore around this case is actually true, but kind of not true. And you'll see what I mean here in a little bit. Well, they got nothing. But 6 months later, in early August of 1977, they got a call from the Evanston police that this doctor, who was a surgical assistant working at Franklin Boulevard Community Hospital, whose wife, Remy Diaz, hereafter known simply as Remy, had worked at the Edgewater Hospital as an inhalation therapist and had some information for the detectives. They were pretty vague about what this information was and how they had gotten it. So, of course, they called this Dr. Jose Shula. Both Jose and Remy were from the Philippines as well, but from different cities than Teresita had been. Jose seemed a little bit embarrassed to speak to the detectives, but said he would come and talk to them because he wanted to help. The first thing that Dr. Chua asks Joseph and Lee is if they believe in the occult or exorcism. And before they can roll their eyes, he says, "Look, I'm a doctor, I'm trained in science and stuff, but there are some things that I can't explain even in the medical field. And that what happened in his house was so bizarre that he didn't want to come forward about it at all." So they listen to what he has to say. Now, I was paraphrasing there. He didn't actually say that in those words, but it's the gist of what he was saying. So a couple of months before this, so like in June or July, he's sitting with Remy in their living room, and she suddenly gets up and walks to the bedroom. But she did it kind of weird, like she didn't say anything. So he follows her into the bedroom to ask, like, what's wrong? Like, maybe she's not feeling well. And she's laying in kind of this catatonic state on their bed. And he calls her name and she answers in this weird voice. She's speaking in Tagalog, which is the language of the Philippines, but with kind of a Spanish accent, and says, "I am Teresita Basa."
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Now, Jose didn't know that name, and she says in the same weird voice that she was murdered by a man named Alan Shorey. And of course, Jose is like, what are you talking about? And in this voice, she goes on to say that Alan had showed up at her apartment around 7 p.m. She had let him in, and Jose asks, like, why would you let him in? And she answered that he was her friend. And while they were in the apartment together alone, he had stabbed her. So Joseph, the detective, asks him if she indicated that she had been raped at all, knowing that this was information that had been held back, and he said, well, she only mentioned being stabbed. And when Remy came out of this trance thing she was in, she didn't remember any of it, not even leaving the living room. So when he asked her about it, she said that she had maybe met Teresita a couple of years ago at an orientation at the hospital, but they worked different shifts, and so they'd never had run into each other. Anyways, they decided that they would look ridiculous going to the police, so they let the matter go. But then it happened again. And this time, Remy, in Teresita's voice, told Jose that Alan had taken some jewelry while he was there and that he had given some of it to his wife and some other pieces to his girlfriend. And she begged Dr. Chula to go to the police with that information. She fully described the pieces of the jewelry to him. And after this episode, Jose told a couple of his trusted colleagues at the hospital where he worked about it, and they were like, yeah, I don't know if you should go to the police with that. It's going to sound a little fishy to them, and they're not going to take you seriously. But when it happened a third time, and again, Teresita's voice imploring him to go to the police, together, Jose and Remy decided to speak to the police, and that's when they had gone to the Evanston police about it. Now, detectives are to look into any and all leads, even from psychics, so they were there to listen to them. Well, Remy didn't have a lot of information to give them. She says that the experience was traumatic, but Jose had told them what Remy had said during these trances. So Joseph and Lee are thinking, well, this is all likely a bunch of baloney, but Alan Shorey does work at the Edgewater, and it matches the initials AS, so they go and they talk to him. Alan Shorey had lived on Surf Street West at the time of Teresita's murder, but had moved with his girlfriend, Yanka Kamluk, to West Schubert. So they visited him at his new apartment, and Alan says that yes, he knew Teresita, but not very well. And yes, they both worked at Edgewater in the respiratory unit. He was a technician there. But then he says, wait a second. Yes, I did go to her apartment, actually, on February 21st to help her repair her TV, but I left early, like 5-ish or so. And while they're discussing this with Alan, they notice this pearl ring that Yanka is wearing, and they ask her about it. Like, hey, that's a nice ring you have there. And she says, oh yes, Alan gave it to me in late February as a belated birthday gift. So that got them thinking, and after a search warrant, they find a jade pendant and some other jewelry, and they get some of Teresita's friends that knew her very well to look at it and identified them as belonging to Teresita. And when confronted with that information, he confessed that he went there to rob her, and he stabbed her and burned her body to conceal his crime. Prosecutor Thomas Organ was assigned to Alan's case, and he said that he was 100% sure that Jose Chula and his wife had nothing to do with this, that he was a learned professional and reputable person, but kind of hinted that there is a solution somewhere, somehow, to every crime. Solving a homicide is like a game of chess, one calculated move at a time, end quote. So on August 13th, 1977, when this case broke, Alan was arrested in the papers, and at that time there was no mention of this voice from the grave. Just that detectives discovered that Alan Shorey had worked in the same unit at the hospital with Teresita, and the initials matched, and that they had known each other well enough that she would have probably bought tickets for something for him. But also that jewelry had been found in his possession belonging to Teresita, There was nothing about a trance or even mention of Dr. Chua. Thomas Organ also never mentioned in his opening statement at Alan's trial about it. He again just mentioned that Alan had been a friend of Teresita's and had come over to fix her television, but had strangled and stabbed her and ransacked her apartment looking for money and valuables and set the place on fire to cover it up. But the defense attorney, Daniel Radokovich, did bring it up in his statement, saying that Remy had worked with Alan and was in the process of being fired from her job there, and the police had only listened to her as a way of getting a lead on a cold case that they had nothing else on, and had coerced Alan into his confession. And so he asked for a dismissal of the charges because the whole thing was ridiculous. Thomas responded that the only issue at hand was if the police had probable cause to arrest Alan, which he said was supported by evidence, and this whole claim of a trance is kind of a moot point. And so the trial continued. So Daniel called Remy as a witness for his side, like the defense, and raked her over the coals about it, suggesting that she had sold the rings to Alan and was angry with Alan for making this crank call to her on July 15th, and that happened to be just the day before this first episode she had, and was also right around the same time that she lost her job. Remy maintained that, quote, "All I remember is hearing the name Alan, I just felt cold and thirsty," end quote, and she denied having anything else to do with the case. So how the trial went down was that the prosecution relied on Alan's 13-page confession that he had gone to Teresita's apartment, that she was a close friend, and that he had robbed her, getting only about $30 in cash and some jewelry. Now, Yannicka said that they had both been home on the night of the murder with some neighbors having drinks and shooting darts. But her initial statement had been that she was at home, she was pregnant at the time of the murder, and he was out doing some electrical work. And that being coerced into a confession didn't really make a lot of sense because Alan was educated and not easily intimidated. He said that he didn't necessarily believe this trance and the voice from the grave thing, but it had led to evidence that pointed to Alan as the killer. Now, during his own testimony, Alan had said that he was just kidding when he gave the confession, and coercion didn't even come into the picture until the defense attorneys brought it up, saying that the detectives, Joseph and Lee, had threatened to arrest Yannicka for the murder if he didn't confess. But the ominous voice theory must have given the jury at least some reasonable doubt because they became deadlocked over it and couldn't reach a verdict after 13 hours of deliberation. And Judge Frank Barbaro had to declare a mistrial. Now, a hearing for the start of a second trial was to be held in late February of 1978. However, against the advice of his lawyer, Alan Showery decided to take a guilty plea and serve less than the 30 years that he would get if convicted by a jury. So he was sentenced to 14 years for the murder, concurrent with 12 years for armed robbery and arson. He actually only served 5 years at the Stateville Correctional Center and was paroled in July of 1983. And no one seems to know where he went after that. There is speculation that he moved to the state of New York. If he is still alive, he would be in his 80s now. And that was the murder of Teresita Bassa. Make of it what you will as to how it was solved. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder that you can skip the ads by signing up on Patreon to A Million Other Choices. If you or someone you love has been a victim of violent crime, please use your online directory to access victim services available in all provinces, territories, and states. You can find specialized services for children, Aboriginal people, and survivors of domestic violence. Some provinces have injury compensation or financial assistance programs. If you are in immediate danger, call 911, or if you are thinking of suicide, please call or text 988.